Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University, and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CLXVI, The Edict of Sacrifice. During the early days of his reign, Emperor Decius issued an edict commanding that all Romans should make a sacrifice for the good of the empire. While some happily went along with it for the good of the empire, for others it went against what they believed in, and not everyone living within the borders of Rome were happy with the emperor's wishes. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
So Decius was born around the year 190 in a village called Budalia, which was near the town of Sirmium in Pannonia Inferior. So that's modern day Serbia, to give you an idea of the region that we're talking about. So he came from the modern day Balkans. His full name, wait for it, Gaius Messius Quintus Decius Valerianus or Valerinus. We're not quite sure. So he comes from the Balkan regions. He may be, Anthony Burley suggests, the descendant of an army officer. We don't know too much more. We can speculate. Sirmium had been a Roman colony since the Flavian period, and it was inhabited by the descendants of Roman soldiers and by native Pannonians. So Decius himself could have been a descendant of a soldier, a Pannonian, or both. But one thing that we'll see very shortly is that Decius was very proud of his origin in Pannonia, but also in the larger Balkans region.
So that's a long time of his career that we've got that is essentially pretty vague. We do know, though, that he had a long career as a politician and that he was well established in those areas, wasn't he?
That's right, yes. So in comparison with the little information about his background, we're quite well informed about the senatorial offices he held. We don't know how he entered the Senate. He must have had a powerful patron, but there was not a long tradition of senators from Pannonia. We have some inscriptional evidence which can help us reconstruct his career. A text from Moesia says that he held a consulship in the reign of Severus Alexander. Then he served the emperor as governor of Moesia Inferior and of Germania Inferior. So these are provinces along the Danube and the Rhine. They're provinces that require the senatorial governor to command legions. So he was obviously a very successful politician and commander.
He did quite well towards the end of the Severan dynasty. Did he manage to stay in favour and continue this under the rule of Maximinus?
Yes, now this is very interesting. Again, we depend on inscriptions for this, but we know he was posted to the province of Hispania Citeria. That's the largest province in Spain, which requires the senatorial governor to command a legion, the Legio Seven Gemina. And we know from inscriptional evidence that he sent a detachment of troops from this legion to protect the Spanish coastline in 238 against any possible naval incursions by the supporters of Pupienus and Balbinus. So this is something we don't find in our literary sources, but suggests that he actually supported Maximinus against the senatorial insurrection in Italy.
So what do we know about his personal life during this time?
Well, like his predecessor, Philip, he made an exceptionally good marriage alliance. So his wife was called Herennia Cupressinia Etruscilla, which is a wonderful name, and she was of Italian senatorial origin. They were probably married by around 220, so when Decius would have been about 30. And they had two sons. The first, Quintus Herennius Etruscus Messius Decius. He's the elder, probably born between 220 and 230. And the younger, birth date is unknown, Gaius Valens Hostilianus Messius Quintus. So for ease of reference, we will call them Herennius Etruscus and Hostilianus. But they don't play much of a role in this episode on Decius. We will return to them in greater detail in the next episode when we talk about Decius's Gothic War.
Does the presence of the name Etruscus indicate any lineage from the Etruscans at all? Or is that just a wishful thinking kind of name?
I think the name indicates connections with the region of Etruria in Italy, certainly. The family is clearly proud of that heritage. They're probably an old senatorial family. Links can be drawn with a consul in the Antonine period. So Decius is a new man. He's coming from Pannonia, where there are very few senators attested, and he's able to make an excellent marriage alliance and have a very, very good military and political career.
Mm. So we know from the previous episode that Decius had quite a good career under the rule of Philip. So that shows that he can adapt quite quickly to new leadership, I suppose, and not fall out of favour too much. Well, quite the opposite here. It seems he flourished and was in favour under Philip.
That's right. You know, this is a man who's served Severus Alexander, Maximinus, now Philip. So, you know, he's survived throughout the times. He may have been urban prefect of the city, which is a top senatorial office in the reign of Philip. And certainly when there is the revolt of Pacatianus on the Danube in 248, it is Decius that Philip turns to go and suppress the revolt. Now, you might remember from the previous episode that Zosimus, the Greek historian, recorded that Decius said, I didn't need to go, you know, the revolt will collapse on its own accord, but Philip sent him anyway, which proved to be a bit of a blunder for Philip, because Decius was right, Pacatianus's troops murdered him, and on the basis of Decius' success against the frontier tribes, the Carpi and the Goths, and his clear military ability, the soldiers there declared him emperor. Philip was then defeated in battle outside of Verona towards the end of 249.
You know, I've been thinking more about that since I started researching Decius, and it really wasn't smart to send a local boy to the troops in Pannonia when they're itching to proclaim somebody emperor.
Yes, you're exactly right. I mean, we can look at it with, you know, hindsight. We can see the big picture, and we can see that throughout the third century, you have legions in the various provinces of the empire that want their own leader, especially if you have someone who has as many connections with the region as Decius does. He is a very tempting candidate as opposed to Philip. So yes, no, certainly in hindsight, we look at it, we think, that really wasn't a smart decision on Philip's part.
So Decius wins against Philip, and Philip's son is put to death, who is co-emperor at that point.
That's right.
So when Decius becomes emperor, then he gets a new imperial name, takes on the purple. We get told that he's a bit apprehensive about it, or that he's not entirely eager to do it, but he seems at this point to embrace it quite well.
Yes, yeah, so we must remember that although Decius has a short reign, it only lasts from September, October of 249 to June of 251. No one ever starts off by thinking they're going to have a short reign. And so Decius starts to craft a public image, which is based on the fact that he is a great military leader and that he's from the Danubian regions. So he takes the name Trajan, first of all. So he becomes Imperator Caesar Gaius Messius Quintus Traianus Decius Augustus. Again, we're not quite sure how this happened, what motivated him to do it, but certainly it is clear he wanted to draw connections between himself and one of Rome's greatest military emperors, especially one who was active in the Danubian region and, of course, created the new province of Dacia.
So his wife becomes Augusta, and his sons become Caesar the following year.
That's right.
So he's very quickly trying to establish a dynasty, or at least make people feel a bit more comfortable about him being emperor with that in line.
Exactly, exactly. As I said, no one starts off wanting to be a short-lived emperor. So there are clear measures being put in place to show that there is going to be a new Decian family dynasty.
Mm. And how else does he align himself with the good emperors?
Yes, and this is something that's really quite fascinating. The fact that he mints a series of coins, which we now call the Dewey series, or the series of deified emperors. 11 imperial predecessors are chosen to be commemorated on coins. You have their head on the obverse, and then on the reverse, the tail side, there is the word consecratio, which is the idea that they have been deified by the state. And so the emperors that were chosen are Augustus, Vespasian, Titus, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius, Commodus, Septimius Severus, and Severus Alexander.
That's interesting, yeah.
And it's thought that Decius wanted to associate himself with these previous good emperors of the Roman past.
The noticeable one that isn't there is Claudius, I suppose, which is interesting.
Yeah, so not all emperors who have been deified made the cut. So Claudius particularly, also Lucius Verus, Pertinax, and Caracalla. And one might raise an eyebrow at the inclusion of Commodus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I guess, you know, even somebody like, you know, Septimius Severus adopted Commodus as his posthumous brother.
That's so, right. That's yeah, right.
There was a reevaluation there of him, I suppose.
Definitely. And the list is very heavy on the Antonine period. You know, we do have Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius, Commodus. The only one who misses out is Lucius Verus there, who was Aurelius's co-emperor. There's very much a link there, we could say, to the good old days, as well, of course, you know, great military leaders like Trajan and Septimius Severus in particular.
And I guess it was this type of public image that he was trying to put forward when he was dealing with Rome as well, wasn't it?
That's right. So because our literary sources are relatively poor, we can turn to the coinage to see what image he wanted to promote. And it's clear that measures are taken right from the beginning of Decius's reign to present him both as a military man, but also as an emperor who comes from the Danubian or Illyrian regions. His administration mints coins with legends such as the army of Illyricum, the spirit of the army of Illyricum, and Pannonii, so the two Pannonian provinces where he was born. There were also types promoting Dacia, the province conquered by Trajan, and one legend has Dacia Felix, so fortunate Dacia. Now, we know that this must have been an initiative from the regime to craft his public image in this particular way for several reasons. The first of all is that the coins are struck at both Rome and at Milan, which now has a mint in the 3rd century, right from the very first issue produced for Decius. So it shows the emperor and the administration taking control of his public image from the beginning of the reign. Secondly, these types are not just restricted to one or two denominations. They appear across gold, silver, and bronze coins, so they're widely minted. And finally, when we look at hoards of coins from the 3rd century, which provide us a good indication of what sort of coin types were in circulation, the Dacia, Pannonia, and the spirit of the Illyrians are the most common coin types found in these hoards, which suggested that they were in wide circulation throughout his reign, and that they're being minted in large numbers. He didn't have a long reign, so they're being minted in large numbers from the beginning. So the iconography of these coins are very similar to Hadrian's famous provincial series, in which personifications of the provinces of the empire are shown, very often shaking hands with the emperor or being raised up by the emperor. However, Decius's only concentrate on provinces in the Danubian region. For example, the Pannonii coins, the ones that show the two Pannonians, has personifications of Pannonia Inferior and Pannonia in Superior holding hands in front of a standard, so in front of a military standard. So here we have an emperor whose Danubian origin can be exploited by the regime as a virtue. And you might like to compare this with, for example, Maximinus, the Thracian, Thrax, who wasn't really from Thrace, but from Moesia, who came from the same region, who was an army officer before seizing power. His coinage is very bland. There's no attempt to sort of shape a new public image that way. However, Decius is a senator. Perhaps he knows the ropes better. And he's saying, you know, this is something that's going to be central to how I present myself to the Roman Empire.
It's also the province that literally put him on the throne as well.
You're right.
So maybe he's showing a bit of loyalty and rewarding them with that sort of honor as well.
Yes, very often it's been suggested that when Roman state mints new coins, it sends them to the legions, it sends them to pay the soldiers. So yes, there's a definite connection there as well.
So this is the first time in a while that Rome has had an emperor who has an established senatorial career. Before this, there's either been soldiers or children. So what was the reception of Decius from Rome?
Decius actually gets a very positive reception in our non-Christian ancient sources. So these are authors like, you know, Aurelius Victor, the Epitome De Caesaribus, the Historia Augusta, although the life doesn't survive, he does mention Decius in other parts, and Zosimus. And we'll see soon why the Christian sources don't talk about him this way. But the non-Christian sources praise him, particularly for his military achievements. The Epitome De Caesaribus 29.2 says he's the readiest in arms, and Zosimus, book 1, chapter 21, says he's renowned for his birth, reputation, and virtue. So he is remembered positively by these writers.
So while he was only emperor for 2 years, we can get a sense of what sort of emperor he was going to try and be. But most of that seems to be through a particular edict that he put in place, isn't it?
That's right. So he moves quite quickly in the first 2 to 3 months of his reign, certainly before the end of 249, to issue what we know as his Edict of Sacrifice. And this shows that he is someone who is going to try and put new policies in place.
So what was the intention of this edict then?
The edict doesn't survive itself. We can reconstruct what it ordered both from the Christian sources, which assume an important role now, and also from papyri from Egypt. This evidence suggests that Decius ordered, through an edict, that everyone in the Roman Empire, and this includes citizens and non-citizens, freedmen, slaves, men and women, children as well, including babies, had to perform a sacrifice to the gods for the safety of the empire. The only group that seemed to have been excluded, and I said we don't have the edict surviving, but this is assumed by scholars, are the Jews. And this is because Romans traditionally respected the antiquity of the Jewish religion. I say usually, you know, if you remember back to what happened in the Flavian period, for example. And there's no tradition of Jewish stories about anyone who died was executed for failing to perform the edict. So on this absence of evidence, scholars suggest that Jews weren't involved, that they didn't have to sacrifice. So the idea is it's universal sacrifice. Everyone has to come together and perform this act for the well-being of the Roman state. So the idea is that people would assemble in their local towns and villages, that they would line up before the temple, they would give sacrifice, they would pour a libation of wine, and they would eat a bit of the sacrificial food. And then after they had done that, they would be issued with a document or certificate, a libellus, to say that they had performed the sacrifice. And then the local magistrates who were in charge of overseeing this signed off on the libellus to show that this had been performed. And people would obviously have to carry the libellus around with them or have it in their family archive. It was a massive bureaucratic undertaking.
And it would have to do things like, you know, rely on the policing of the public and censuses as well to make sure that you got everyone.
That's right.
We've got some of the libels, don't we? Mm. The documentations about this. So people essentially getting a license or a form to say that they've done the sacrifice.
That's right. 45 of these documents survive from Egypt. Of course, we have papyri that are exceptionally well preserved. It's assumed that the process was the same empire-wide, but wow, they don't survive. So I'll quote a translation of one such papyrus from the Greek, translated in A.D. Lee's Pagans and Christians, a source book. So it says, "To those appointed to oversee the sacrifices, from Aurelius Sarkis from the village of Theoxenus, with his children Aeon and Heras staying in the village of Theadelphia. We have always sacrificed the gods, and now in your presence, in accordance with the decree, we have offered sacrifice, and we have poured a libation, and we have eaten of the sacrificial offering, and we ask you to undersign. May you continue to prosper." And then in another hand, we have the magistrates who are signing off. "We, Aurelius Serenus and Aurelius Hermas, saw you sacrificing."
That's amazing. That's so cool.
Yeah, I know. It's you know, incredible to detect that it's a different hand that, you know, it's been presented to the magistrates. They've just signed off on it.
Sure.
And then it concludes with the date, the year one of the Emperor Caesar, Gaius Messius Quintus Trajan Decius, Pius Felix Augustus, and then the Egyptian date, which is Palmy 23, which we know is the 17th of June 250.
Right.
So, you know, it's a massive undertaking to assemble people throughout the empire to go to temples, to perform the rites, and then issue all these libelli, which have to be signed off. So people who think in the third century, you know, everything's gone to pot and people are sort of running around screaming in crisis, you know, all the time, that's really not the case. You know, the Roman Empire can still organize such massive bureaucratic undertakings.
So two things occur to me here. One is that we're told that this was done for the safety of the empire. Was the empire under so much threat that it required this, or was it potentially from Dacius / the Romans' point of view that Rome has lost its way a bit and the gods need this sort of signal?
Mm. Yes, no, it's an excellent question. This is something that historians have puzzled over. The fact is that no source records the edict in full, nor Decius's motivation. So we have to reconstruct from the actions plausibility. And it seems that, yes, that there are pressures on the frontiers, particularly the Danube, but also we've seen in the past the eastern frontier with the newly ascendant Persian Sasanian Empire. And secondly, the idea that if you have everyone come together at the beginning of your reign, the entire populace of the empire is not only sacrificing the gods to the empire, but also for your reign and the empire to flourish under your rule. So it's probable that there was thinking that an empire-wide show of piety and devotion to the gods would help both Decius and the Roman state. The religious historian J.B. Rives, who's written an influential article on this, says that Decius is really trying to restructure the religious organization of the empire, moving away from sort of leaving things up to local inhabitants and local temples to show piety and devotion in the way they wanted to having state-mandated universal displays of devotion to the gods. So it's a shift in thinking, and we will see these kind of edicts again in the 3rd and early 4th centuries.
So this doesn't strike me as Christian persecution in intention, but that may have been the way that it ended up, or that's the way that we interpret it now because we've got the commentary from Christian sources. So what was that angle of this edict?
Yes, certainly Christians remembered Decius as a persecuting emperor. There is no doubt that he has a very negative reputation in contemporary and later Christian sources. We don't have the text of the edict surviving, as I mentioned, But yes, it's not specifically all Christians do this. It's all people in the empire do this. But of course, the Christians are going to be affected because they do not want to sacrifice to the gods. They will certainly sacrifice on behalf of the emperor, but they would not perform the rites as Decius outlined. And certainly there were going to be negative consequences. So people who on the local level refused to sacrifice were handed over by the magistrates to the provincial administrators, usually the governors, to stand trial. And then it was up to the governor to impose the penalty, which could range from exile to death and then various forms of execution, depending on your status. So certainly, you know, the Christians are going to be affected.
Do we have accounts of the Christian experience of this edict and what happened to them?
Yes, so we're actually rather well informed. A couple of different sources. The first are the letters of Cyprian, who is the Bishop of Carthage at this time. Also, first-hand accounts by Dionysius, the Bishop of Alexandria, that are preserved in Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, written in the early 4th century. And we also have some martyr acts from this period as well. Very often, you know, the 3rd century, we talk about the lack of literary sources. Suddenly, there's a huge amount when the Christians are concerned there. So we know that Christians who refuse to sacrifice were punished by either imprisonment or death. The first known victim was the Bishop of Rome, Fabian, who was put to death on either the 19th or 20th of January 250. And we also know that bishops of Antioch and Jerusalem died in prison after they refused to sacrifice. The punishments that were meted out to Christians who refused differed. Some Christians were burned alive. Others were beheaded. Usually the act of beheading, decollatio, was reserved for Roman citizens or those of higher status because it was seen as a more merciful end. Now we have a martyrdom from Asia Minor. So this is modern day Turkey. It's the martyrdom of Pionius and his fellow Christians. And this provides us with an indication of how the Roman state dealt with recalcitrant Christians. Pionius and his fellow Christians are brought before the crowds and they refuse to sacrifice. They're then imprisoned and they have to wait for the Roman proconsul Quintilianus to arrive on his assize tour. So the governors would tour the different major cities to sit in judgment. And then we have record of the trial scene and the exchange between the governor and Pionius. The governor Quintilianus says, "Change your mind. Why have you lost your senses?" And Pionius replies, "I have not lost my senses, but I fear the living God." And as a result of this refusal, Quintilianus orders Pionius to be burnt alive. Now, these sort of texts circulated because they were designed to inspire Christians to maintain their faith in Christ despite punishments by worldly governments. They maintain their faith even as they face death in all sorts of terrible ways. So Pionius is said to be filled with a great joy as he's being nailed to a cross in the arena. And then he prays as the guards pile the woods around the base of the cross. And as the flames start to ascend, he prays to God to receive his soul. These are texts which probably began to circulate as stories before being written down or letters that were sent between different Christian communities to encourage and exhort them to stand firm.
It's interesting to hear that perspective of it, but I can't help but think that there would have been plenty of Christians who would have been more than happy to make the sacrifice, even if it's the sort of thing that they did just in public and then go back to practicing their own religion.
Yes, exactly. So this is something else that happened. So other Christians lapsed or fell from their faith. They're called the lapsi, the fallen, and they sacrificed to the gods in order to escape punishment. So we have accounts of this thanks to the letters of Dionysius, the Bishop of Alexandria, preserved by Eusebius. And I'm going to quote a passage from Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, which is written by Dionysius, Book 6, Chapter 49, Subchapter 11 to 13. So he wrote, "Called by name, they approach the impure and unholy sacrifices, some pale and trembling, as if they were not sacrificing, but rather to be themselves the sacrifices and victims to the idols, so that the large crowd that stood around heaped mockery upon them, and was evident that they were by nature cowards in everything, cowards both to die and to sacrifice. But others ran eagerly towards the altars, affirming by their forwardness that they had not been Christians even formerly, concerning whom the Lord very truly predicted that they should hardly be saved. Of the rest, some followed one or other of these, others fled, some were captured, and of these some went as far as bonds and imprisonment, and certain, when they had been shut up for many days, then forswore themselves even before coming into court, while others who remained firm for a certain time under tortures subsequently gave in." So you have the stories here, you know, this, you know, gives you a sense of the pressure that Christians face. It was very much a public event when people had to sacrifice. So Dionysius says, you know, some people, they just went and did it. They were so eager, they did not want to even seem that they had been Christians once before. Others flee. That's really important as well, that, you know, if you can escape the long arm of the Roman state, you could hopefully ride this out. And one of the people who did this was the Bishop of Carthage, which caused a bit of controversy later, because rather than face martyrdom, he escaped into the countryside of North Africa. So some Christians took a different approach. You could buy a pre-filled out libellus from corrupt officials, so if you had enough money. However, the Christian church believed that such an action was a denial of Christian faith. So it wasn't just a document in their mind. So these Christians were also included amongst the fallen, the lapsi, along with those who sacrificed.
It's interesting that it's become a test either way.
Yeah.
For the Romans, it's become a test of your faith. For the Christians, it's become a test of your faith, how you react to these orders.
Exactly, exactly. Do you support the gods, or do you, you know, yeah, do you believe in Christ?
The God.
Yeah, the God. Exactly, exactly. So Cyprian, who he'd run away, wrote in one of his letters, this is letter 55, "The person who was thus tainted with the certificate has learnt from our admonitions that he ought not to have done even this, and that even though his hands remain undefiled and his mouth unpolluted by any contact with that deadly food, his conscience nonetheless has been polluted." So the idea that even though you did not perform the libation itself, you didn't eat the sacrificial food, your conscience has been polluted because you have given in to the Roman state. And so this produced schisms within the church itself. Some people thought that the fallen should be readmitted, no questions asked. Cyprian said, well, no, only if they've performed acts of penitence. Quite a different Christian reaction depending on very often the local leadership. Some bishops or priests sacrifice and advise their congregations to do the same just to escape punishment. But this, you know, after Decius's death, led to problems within the Christian church. So different splinter groups who had different views upon whether the fallen should be readmitted to communion.
Okay, so it sounds like the sort of thing that had repercussions within the Christian community for a lot longer than it would have had within the Roman community, this edict.
Definitely, definitely. And we can see this from Cyprian's letters. He also wrote a tract called On the Fallen as well. So, you know, we were particularly well informed about the situation in North Africa. It did definitely resonate. We can reconstruct a little bit of the pagan or the traditional Roman point of view to see that there was some support for what Decius was doing. So we have two inscriptions. One comes from Cosa in Italy, which records Decius as restorer of the sacred rights and freedom, well, as another from Moesia Inferior describes him as the founder of the rites of the city. We'd expect these to be positive and flattering, but what's interesting is that they do make specific reference to Decius's religious policy, which shows that it did have an impact and that there was support for it amongst those who followed the traditional Roman religion.
As a result of this edict, though, he's got a very negative reputation in later history then, I suppose, because a lot of the sources that we rely on for Christian were seeing him through their lens. And because his reign was so short, we don't have much else on him.
Yes. So, I mean, we're exceptionally well informed about the Christian perspective. For them, Decius' short reign was a form of divine retribution. We will see next episode that he dies in battle, which traditional Roman sources interpret as a glorious death, sacrificing himself for the state. But for the Christians, it's a sign that he was an unworthy emperor.
That's Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, Decius takes on the Goths and learns a rather harsh lesson about rushing into battle. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.